Hello, my name is Elizabeth Klink, and I'm delighted to be part of Industry Insights, the EFM podcast being presented by the European Film Market of the Berlinale. This season of Industry Insights, the EFM podcast, puts a spotlight on highly topical and trend-setting industry issues, creating a compass for the forthcoming film year. The year-round podcast is produced in cooperation with the Goethe Institute and is co-funded by Creative Europe Media. This year, EFM is proud to announce that its ever-popular archive market will be taking place on Tuesday, February 20th from 11 to 5 p.m. as part of the European Film Market. This year, as was last year, it will be located at the Documentation Center for Displacement, Expulsion, and Reconciliation. This building is very close to the EFM Center in the Martin Gropius Bau. And last year, it was the premiere of the event in this location, and as the European Film Market is constantly growing, there was need for a bit more space for the archive market. Our first guest, Monica Preischel, has worked for many years as an archive producer for documentary and fictional productions worldwide. In 2019, she was honored with the Focal Award for her work on Kulenkampfs Schuhe, and in 2023 for Gladbeck. She is the chairwoman of the newly founded professional association, GRAP, which represents the interests of German archive researchers and archive producers in touch with both broadcasters and producers. Finally, she is working on the documentary Riefenstahl since 2018, and that's dedication. I also want to talk a little bit about some of the work that she's done in putting together this archive market. Without her, this market would probably not happen. So, Monica, thank you for that. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how it started and where the idea came from and where we're going with the Archive Day and the archive market?
Yeah, thank you, Elizabeth, for this wonderful introduction. So thanks that we can share a little bit our work. You also as an international archive producer based in Canada. And, you know, we were always looking at your association. You are like, you know, someone where we also shared all this information about that we could like collect a little bit of skills of colleagues and whatever, and focus on our work. And so I think I started in 2018 to talk with the first person at the European Film Market that about the idea of setting up an archive market, because it's very important that we have a place to meet for networking, to come together and also talk about the needs of productions, of producers, of archives as well. So it would be a good challenge to set this up. So in the end, we started the first edition in 2020. And I think it was the last huge event in Germany before Corona took over. But it was successful. And we were so full of joy. And everyone was like, yeah, this is the starting point. So yeah, then came like a long distance walk with hybrid or online meetings only, but we still kept this idea. And so last year we could like have the second edition of the really on-site market. This year we have around 18 exhibitors, and we also set up a really, really interesting talk program. So we have we call it coffee talks in the afternoon starting at 2 p.m. And also what is really new this year is like our first edition of a big talk, a panel with international guests at 5 p.m. And we have guests like Andres Feil, so he's very well known as a documentary filmmaker, also for fiction films. I work with him together for many, many years, and also on the project Riefenstahl, as you mentioned. It's a very special topic, and it's a workshop talk, so it's still in production, so it's very interesting. We are still in production, and hopefully we are finishing soon. And where I'm very happy about, we have the director on the stage, Farhanas Sharifi. She is an Iranian filmmaker, and she's have a world premiere on Wednesday 21st with her film Stolen Planet. And she has also made a film about, let's say, archived memories, I would say. And and also myself, I will be on the stage a little bit presenting the archive producer's view on that. So we have I think a really interesting day.
Wonderful. And the workshop is always such a well-attended and well-loved program, because it's one of the rare opportunities that archive producers and directors and editors get to really kind of dig deep and find out, how do these things get made, and what's the best way to work with one another. And so by having the directors and archive producer on the same stage, I always think that people learn a great deal. There's also the speed dating with some of the members from GRAP that will be part of the day. And I also know that there's going to be a wonderful announcement from the Bundesarchiv and finishing up with a lovely happy hour. So it's a full day. I'm very excited. Again, that will be on Tuesday, February the 20th. And I can't wait to see all of you in person again. We did do a good job keeping it online for those 2 years. And I'm so delighted that EFM has been such a support for archives in general, and archives specifically, with some of the panels that they've produced. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, what were some of your challenges last year, and maybe the last couple of years, in terms of the association, and also fighting for some of the accreditation, for example, or just networking? What were some of the things that you participated in last year?
Yes, I think that we had in the last years, let's say, as archive producer, really to fight with, at least that with a, to be visible, you know, not only to tell people about what is a profession archive producer. I still have to explain, so I'm not working as an archivist. I mean, maybe sometimes I do, but not. I'm not especially working in one specific archive or for an archive. So what is an archive producer doing? And still, I think we have to translate and transmit. Yeah, and so the transmission is a huge topic. And also that I see that in the last years, the maybe the directors become younger.
Yes.
And sometimes a bit less experienced. Also maybe some production companies, I see that they maybe shrink, you know, in all their having not the same stuff or employees than maybe before Corona. Sometimes I'm working with production where there is only one person or two persons. So we overtake more and more, let's say, also part of the work of producers, or from, you know, let's say previous, what the production work, what was the production work on their side. So it's becomes more and more complex in a way. Yeah. So we are not only researchers, we are not only researching, we're sometimes working also in the part of development. So we bring in our ideas, or maybe also we have some ideas where to find like personal archives or material which is like, you know, not in that, let's say, commercial archives to be found. And so we are also working a lot. And I think this is something, there is a big increase in the right clearance. I see that most of the productions are searching for this, you know, to feel safe, or, you know, no one wants to have a big or bad surprise during the editing. And if you have finished the production, that you have still this risk, you know, keeping that risk. So, and working with archive, that always means to be a little bit flexible, also to have a risk management and estimation of what can happen. And I think what we have as archive producers, where we work all the time, you know, with this kind of material, we have a lot of experience, and we can really share this from the beginning. So I would say also when I'm teaching, giving seminars or workshops, this is something maybe before you go for financing, or let's say if you apply with your project at broadcasters or streamers or whatever, that you really a bit think about, you know, what you're gonna plan, what are the archives, what are the sources. Yeah, I mean, we still fight for working with sources. Maybe the topic AI will also come up, and we as like me and also my colleagues, we are looking a little bit like with an happy eye and a sad eye on that. We don't know how this will change all the material which is around digital. Still, archives who are not accessible are a bit protected. But this is like the thing we are also working on, that archives get accessible, and that it lowers the borders. So still, there's a lot to do. And I see that there's a really big need for getting together in person and talk with archives, talk with producers, bring all these levels together. And this is a great opportunity for, having the archive market.
Thank you, Monica, for all of those excellent points you've made. I know it's a challenge at the moment, and there's a lot of things that your organization has been working on, but I'd like to bring it around to a more personal opinion from you, if I may. What would be your personal wish for archive producing and archive researching in Germany, and for your group? Is there something that you'd like to see change or happen or develop?
Still, I think a huge personal wish is that we are visible, that we are, as archive producers, are seen and noticed. Also, I'm very happy that we can now get our accreditation at Berlinale and the EFM as in our profession. It was also a huge challenge. But beside of that, I'm also working on a specific topic where I think that we have in Germany a very special responsibility, because, you know, we keep that material of Nazi propaganda material in the archives, and we are always asked as specialists on that. And I see that people making profit out of that, and I think that should not be done like that. We have a ethic moral responsibility on that, so I'm a bit working on that it's accessible on the one side, but we have to be very careful with that material, and it should be usable, and it should be not in private hands, you know. If you see maybe sometimes material, amateur material with a crime scene or so, I mean, should someone make profit out of that? I don't think so. So it's a huge topic, and I still hope that I find people who are working with me on that. And yes, that's something it's maybe a personal challenge for me.
And what an honorable one. I know that it's a very important one that is addressed within the archive community. And as you say, the public accessibility is something that I think we're always grappling with. And I'm delighted to hear that this is something that you're working on. And I know if you're working on it, there will be change happening. I also wanted to just find out what your outlook is for next year and the years coming. I know there's some changes at the Federal Archive, at the Bundesarchiv, that we're going to be hearing about on Archive Day. And there probably will be some new developments. But personally, what's ahead for you?
I mean, I think also that in the film market, there is a change going on. I think already like last year, I see it in like my productions I'm working with. So less streamers, I would say. Not as much of this doc-heavy series are around. We are also in contact with groups in the UK or in France, and we see that it's everything is connected like to the world economy in a way. I personally work more at the moment for TV broadcasters or theatrical release. I mean, I love to go back to cinema, but let's see how it will change. I mean, also maybe a big challenge, but still, I think as we are close to archives and that we, you know, search for archive-driven stories, that's something where we still work for, and also that people, like, let's say people who are talking about their experiences like in the Second World War, so they are all dead now. I mean, the last survivors are, you know, not available anymore. So how are we gonna tell the story? So there is a change and we have to, you know, work all together on that.
Absolutely. That's some of our most important jobs is the preservation of the storytelling, and also making sure those stories are kept in front of today's audience and tomorrow's audience. I'm looking forward to speaking with our next guest, our producer, Marc Lepetit, and I thank you, Monica, for all of your insights and your continuing excellent work that you're doing as the chairwoman of GRAP, the German Researchers and Archive Producers, and all of the excellent work that you have done with the EFM to make the Archive Day happen. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
I'm so delighted to have with us Marc Lepetit, who has been working as a producer since graduating from his studies at the very prestigious Film Academy Baden-Württemberg. After moving to UFA Fiction, Marc worked as a producer for the multi-award-winning event series Kudam and various feature-length films. Kill Your Darling was the first major transmedia project in Germany, produced in 2009. Other projects that Marc has been involved with are Hannelore Kohl, Die Erste Frau, Die Ungewollten, Die Irrfahrt der St. Louis, and most recently, Der große Fake, Die Wirecard Story. In April 2021, Marc founded the UFA Documentary Department, which is responsible for non-fictional productions and hybrids under the UFA production umbrella. His first production included the RTL series Angela Merkel, Mrs. Chancellor, and a project about Boris Herman. The four-part series Love is Everything about the Berlin band Rosenstolz was also one of the first highlights in 2021. In addition to being a very busy producer, Marc has been teaching as a guest lecturer at various universities throughout Europe since 2006. He is a lecturer in transmedia storytelling at the Zurich University of the Arts. I was delighted to see you, Marc, and delighted to have you here on our first podcast for the EFM Archive Market Day. You were at our Market Day last year in Berlin, and I just enjoyed speaking to you so much. So I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about some of the things we touched on. And one of the first things was, what is the access like now for you as a producer at UFA to some of the public broadcaster archives? Are you having any success?
Well, it's good to be with you on the podcast, first of all, and thanks for inviting me. So it's even if we don't see each other now physically, it's nice to listen to you guys and talk. So I guess, you know, honestly, we were talking a lot about how complicated it got to, you know, have constant and very clear deal terms with broadcasters if it comes to cooperation with streamers or with other broadcasters, that there is not a very clear line that makes everybody happy, including producers, archive producers, and partners. I think there had been a huge movement from all these archive owners that are not, you know, with public broadcasters to figure out business models that are working for producers. That makes it a little bit more easier. But talking about broadcasts, that it's still, I remember that we made jokes of that. It still feels a little like the wild, wild west. Like if you're cooperating within broadcasters' worlds, handshakes are easily done. If you have a streamer who is giving away a contract and you ask a broadcaster if you can use material, it's still like, yeah, we'll figure something out. And the numbers could be very high, or if they're interested to find a good model, very low. But there is not yet a solid model that we can work with.
And how would you say it is in terms of dealing with some of the private German archives that will be at the archive market in February?
Yeah, we started discussions in Cannes last year with Getty and others. And the energy to become a partner in projects is very interesting, because they don't see each other than just finding bits and pieces within the archive. AI and whatever they use makes them very, very successful and find almost everything. But they understand that there is a chance of cooperating and create unique and proper content out of their archives without including broadcast or streaming partners, and make that a partnership where they could be kind of a silent co-production partner. And that's very interesting. And the energy in these discussions is just fascinating, because they start to see each other as co-producers, not just archive boys and girls.
And it's wonderful, because they become quite embedded in the project, and the ownership of their archive being used in co-production with a producer, I think, always brings a great energy, as you mentioned. Although there is one caveat: you need to have a certain amount of material to make something like this worthwhile. And that's a challenge that often comes up with producers. Is there enough in one particular archive to make a partnership worthwhile? And what do you think the tipping point would be for that?
Thinking about that a lot, the discussions that we started, it was who is in charge, if you know what I mean. It's about who has the idea. It doesn't make any sense to sit down and say, okay, do you have an idea? Because they are not at that point right now. If you bring an idea to the table, it's enormous what kind of sources and what kind of material could come out of these discussions. But it doesn't make any sense to really see them as unique creative production partners. They are still in the phase of figuring out what nuggets do they have in the basement and what is still yet not used. And it's our work as creatives to pinpoint ideas where they're like, oh, we have that in our library and we didn't find a way to use it, so probably hold it back and do something different. To the point, and I met a producer from the US who focuses on using AI to really seek through every archive out there and saying, okay, his pitching situation is wholly different to what we do. He is approaching networks saying, I want to do a 10 episode series about Egypt. And the network is like, yes, let's do it. He doesn't have to shoot. He more or less just goes to the editing room, gets every material he can get from all the archives, and with that, he creates 10 episodes out of nothing. And this is where they are partnering up. So it's a wild situation right now, but very interesting for both archive producers, archive owners, and producers like UFA.
And it's a wonderful, as you say, there's so many co-ownerships that occur under some of these large archives that have access to not only material in their own country, but through other countries' materials as well. On a purely business level, how do you work it out in terms, is it a 50-50 deal or is it a 51-49? Or because in terms of the copyright, is it seen purely as half and half, or do the producers generally retain a majority shareholder position?
From UFA side, we yet did not start to really figuring that out. We're still trying to find the right subjects that we focus on. Mm-hmm. But what I learned from that partner in the US, that's an interesting deal, because he will ask them to come in as a real co-production partner. And the second, where he is doing deal terms with a network or a broadcaster, he will share whatever comes in. So it's kind of there's a risk in the beginning, but if they are successful, they will probably make more money than they expect. And talking about Getty and others, they are interested in, you know, inventing new business models besides saying, okay, you get the rights for 10 years, but saying if it's a success, the amount of money that we can get out of that could be more interesting. We are still, I did last year a series for Amazon called All or Nothing. We are still in the field of making overall 100% usage deals with partners. And, you know, that business has been around for a while. They're not really interested in figuring out how much money they can make out of that. So it's still, it's growing. It's in the beginning.
And I think what we've observed over the past 4 or 5 years, thankfully in part due to the pandemic, is there's a real appetite for material that's archive heavy, and archive is the main protagonist in the documentary or in the series. And so this is a wonderful way for people to do more of a deep dive into a subject if they've already done, say, a 90-minute or a 75-minute project, to then perhaps spin it out with access to this material into a 4-part series or a 6-part series. And I think it's lots of potential and lots of interesting opportunities. You did mention the AI words, the initials, and I wanted to get a little bit of feedback from you just in terms of what your current position is on AI in terms of how you're working with material. And, you know, I always like to think there's the good, the bad, and the ugly, and we want to look at the good, but we also have to be cognizant of the bad and perhaps even the ugly. So do you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us?
We tried, you know, the big thing is, at what phase of your production are you going to use AI? I jumped into Firefly a couple of months ago. I've been to a presentation. If you don't know it, it is the new Adobe tool, more or less, to manipulate whatever is out there. It's really smart. It's really intuitive. It's fascinating to see, but you're right. There is a little touch of the evil behind it. You know, even if they keep on saying during their presentations, everything you do is going through different phases of, is it real? Is it not real? Where does the material come? Do we own the rights? Blah, blah, blah. So what we do is we try to use AI mainly to, do a deeper dive into what's out there in the internet and out there in archives, because some of these tools are smarter than the usual let's Google something, for sure. If it comes to post-production, it's a whole different game. The quality to improve old material that is in a bad shape, to work with it, to go into details. You remember how long it took when you went to the real old archives and tried to find material, and then you get it back and it's really not in a good shape. AI is of huge help if it comes to the quality of the picture, but also, and that is amazing, in the quality of the sound, which is sometimes in archive material even more important. If you want to, you know, find details, AI could be of a big help. Again, talking about deepfake, etc., etc., it's also dangerous, so we have to be quite sure and quite serious about, if we use AI, what are the deal terms? What are we doing it there? Are we manipulating anything? And that's important.
And I'm glad you mentioned sound, because I've been party to a few pitches where they're talking about sampling the voices of some very famous filmmakers and famous political figures, and then using that archival interview material to then help to produce the narration for a film. And I know that there are some broadcasters who are not comfortable with that, and there's some countries where I don't think that's going to fly. Have you looked into doing that at all in your company?
Sometimes, you know, if you do an interview, we did a docufiction last year with Margot Friedländer, who is a 102-year-old Holocaust survivor. So once in a while, if you go through the interviews, you will recognize that the quality of the sound needs improvement, and that she kind of, because she has her problems in talking, so we help her by just improving her voice. It's easily be done with AI. We would never ever implement new words or change pauses. So if it comes to that kind of level, I guess AI could be of a help, because it will just help sound engineers to improve for us to understand what's been said. Because the quality, as you know, if you look at all these old speeches, it's difficult to understand what they say. You can push the audience a little bit back. You get the right speech in the front. I think in that terms, it's totally okay. But if it really comes to manipulate, I'm out, honestly.
I know. Well, one of the thoughts that was presented was taking letters and having the voice that has been sampled read those letters. And I thought, you know, that's a difficult kind of situation, because oftentimes things that are written don't have the same emphasis as when they're spoken, or it's open to interpretation or artistic interpretation. So there's lots to think and talk about. And I know the AI panels at film festivals around the world in the coming years will be wonderfully informative and probably very well attended. So thank you for your insight, because I knew you would be thinking about that. I wanted to ask you what some of your plans and goals are for not just 2024, but I know you think well ahead and well into 2025. Do you have some projects that you're hoping will come to fruition? I don't want you to belie any confidences, but perhaps you can share the things that you can share and let us know what you're up to and what maybe some of the archival challenges in some of those projects that you're anticipating.
Out of the stories that we told, you mentioned St. Louis, I mentioned Margot Friedlander, we do have still a huge need to tell German or European story in a different way. And this is what I love to emphasize. I love these stories, but I'm not comfortable in retelling what happened over and over again. It needs to have a different angle. It needs to have a different character. It needs to have somebody who's really been involved. And so going through these archives, it's really, if our producers jump into that, they try to find personal, very close to a character stories that we would love to pick and tell the stories that we know around it, like we did with Margot. Margot, she doesn't like if we say she hide, but she did hide somewhere in Berlin to get away from Gestapo. She doesn't like the word hiding, so hopefully she's not listening to that. But she really, we had 20 days of interviews with her, and we read the book, and so we knew a lot about it, and we tried to retell what happened in between 40 and 45 in a different way. So I think this is going to be, for all the big broadcasters, a big issue to describe personal stories, not just from the Third Reich, but also going into the time in between 45 and 60, because this is still kind of in Germany and I guess in the UK, looking at a project like Lola opens up, you know, where they are in their storytelling. So we are not that far behind. So I guess it's interesting to find these kind of stories again, more personal, more character driven than, and in 1990 blah started this and that, and then going into linear storytelling. So it's really, if I would give a signal to archive producers, go into more personal stories than focusing on finding new material, how Hitler destroyed the world. We know that it's been out there. If it comes to contemporary, everybody loves music, same problem. They are seeking for personal story. You did Zappa, there's been a lot of story in it, and you know, it's been a kickoff, and you went deeper and deeper in his character and found out what his energy, his motor is. And that's what the streamers and the networks are looking for. Very simple, more character work, less, okay, there's been an incident and let's go from this point to that point and fill in the linear time escape. So it's really the personal story that we're looking for. So we're doing that. We're going to do a huge story about one of these characters who's been in the circus business for 40 years, and he's opening up his archive, which is enormous. And it's huge fun for archive producers to go there, because it's, I guess, something like 60,000 square meter of material.
Wow.
So it's just great. I hope to do a story about a very famous politician here in Germany whose energy comes from his father, who's been kind of a revolutionary guy back in the 50s. So you can tell his DNA from his father's side. You can, you know, use both of materials. There are so many projects. And again, I'm not going to put out too much information, but this is the way that we want to go, hopefully.
And always storytelling and the story itself is the main thrust. And that's why your projects are so memorable and so well produced. And Marc Le Petit from UFA Fiction and UFA, your new transmedia projects and also all of the factual work you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us today. And best of luck with your very interesting projects. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you. Thank you, Marc.
Thank you for your questions. Have a great day.
Our next guest is Amanda Huntley, who is the Managing Director of Huntley Film Archives in the UK. For nearly 40 years, she has been working with their very unique collection and has a huge passion for celluloid and documentary history on film. Amanda works with production companies, broadcasters, museums, advertisements, and educational clients. She always aims for excellence, historical truth, and creativity in how her company's archive film assets are used. It's a wonderful knowledge for all of us to know that her film collections are being scanned to digital and are available to view on their very interesting interactive website. Huntley Film Archives has always been fiercely independent, and they aim to conserve and preserve their film collections by using the revenues they make from commercial sales. It's a point of honor that they do not receive any public funding for their restoration work, and yet they're able to maintain the highest standards. Amanda and her company promote film archive training through courses and through internships. And I always like to mention that one of her hobbies is breeding llamas. So, Amanda, it's wonderful to see you. You and I have known each other for many, many years, and you were always such a lodestar for me in the archive business because you did retain such integrity about the work that you do. And I was delighted to see that you were at the last year's EFM archive market. And what was that like to participate at the Berlin market last year for you?
It was wonderful, Elizabeth. I really enjoyed it, and I made lots of really useful contacts as well. And I don't know, just to have an environment where you can talk archive all day is always a great pleasure. And I particularly love working with the German producers because I find they already come with a great understanding. I don't have to explain as much as I do in other shows that I do. Sometimes you have to sort of explain what an archive does and what sort of services we can offer. And I love the German shows because, particularly the sort of German archive producers, because they come with that understanding already. And maybe it's a cultural thing that Europe has a sort of deeper connection with the idea that film can be documentary, can be a way of showing life as it is and as it was. Perhaps more than, dare I say, the USA, where perhaps feature film is a more predominant style.
I think it's true. And it was delightful to see the growth of the German Research Archive Producers Association, GRAP. And I thought it was wonderful that people from outside of Germany were there to meet and greet some of their members who have a lot of expertise and have a lot of very interesting projects in their curriculum vitae. And as you say, just any opportunity to sit and chat about archives. And that's often when the best ideas come about, because someone asks about your collection and then they might spark an idea. Did that happen last year?
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, a bit like Mark's been talking about. It's a matter of keeping up with the trends and the sort of zeitgeist around what people really want to watch. I mean, you already pointed out that archive has sort of continued as a trend, as a something that people really want to hear and people really want to see. But how you form that narrative from the archive does change over the years. And we're finding that there's... you were talking earlier, I hope I'm not jumping in too soon, but we were talking earlier about AI. And I think the most interesting part of the whole question around AI for me as an archivist is, surely somebody sits down to watch a program because they want to see the truth of the archives that they're looking at. And if we start replacing that with AI, doesn't it remove the purpose of that film almost at a fundamental level? So I'm a little confused myself as to where AI is going. But certainly at the archive market last year, we were talking about some of these issues and how it might affect all the way we work.
It is. And as I know, you really do hold the veracity of your collection, and the even your social media presence is always a delight to follow you on LinkedIn and different platforms, because you bring a very interesting clip to everyone's attention. But there's the backstory is very well researched and well cataloged and captioned. And I think that's something that as an archive producer, we all appreciate when there's that time and care taken so that it isn't just put up there quickly with not too much thought and not too much, as I say, backstory or information, because that really does help.
Oh, my goodness, Elizabeth. I mean, you couldn't have really said that at a more pertinent moment, because we're really reanalyzing the amount of time and effort we do with our cataloguing. And it has been put to us that some people find it inaccessible, that we're overloading with too much information. And we've begun to think that perhaps we should copy other archives' model, where you just use a certain number of key, sort of pertinent keywords, really. So it's really interesting you should raise that particular topic, because obviously it does kind of, it's quite labour intensive. It takes an enormous amount of effort to produce catalogue entries the way that we do. But we do sometimes wonder whether it is a counterproductive thing in terms of commerciality, I suppose. I mean, I've always wanted to do things the best we can, but you do sometimes have to balance that about how much it costs to run the archive. I don't want to sound as if I'm being bleating about on about this, but, you know, we do have to weigh these things up. And we've kind of this morning, we're discussing whether we should abandon the way we're cataloguing now because of that labour intensivity element. But if you're sitting there saying to me, this is what the producers love, in a way, it makes me reflect again, and maybe perhaps we shouldn't jump to that conclusion.
Well, I guess it probably depends on the type of projects that people are coming to you about. If you're looking at something that's quite, a deep dive into a certain topic, that kind of information is so invaluable, as opposed to, you know, my famous story. I remember trying to track down Winston Churchill when he came to visit FDR at the White House over Christmas during the war. And the keyword said, man in bowler hat, smoke cigar in garden. And in fact, it was Winston Churchill. So.
Oh, God.
I love detail, and I love good background information, but I can also see where someone who's doing something that's quite, they want a lot of information and a lot of not so detailed information, depending on their project, that might be something that you do have to consider at some point, just as you say, for the commercial value of it. It's a tough walk to walk, isn't it?
It is a tough walk. And, you know, we do analyze the way we do things all the time. We do want to produce a really good service for producers, but sometimes we might misunderstand what they really need. And I think that might be a case in point. For example, on my website, you'll find the films as whole. You'll find whole films. You can run whole 20, 31, sometimes an hour long films and see the film as the filmmaker intended. But again, I'm beginning to doubt whether that's a good policy. And perhaps I would be better flipping my films into smaller chunks. And I can see that that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it makes it accessible for people to get exactly what they want exactly in front of them. And producers, archive producers, are all sort of time poor people. And if I'm making them trawl through a whole 20 minute film to get to the section they want, I have to wonder whether my policy has been a bit too protective of the original filmmaker and not necessarily quite right for the needs of the producer now.
It could be, too, that I often bring in entire films at the very early stages of a film before I'm actually bringing in clips, but just trying to get a sense of what other people have done and how people in different decades dealt with the story. So for me, to be able to see the entire film is always a delight. And I often find great cutaways and things that maybe you wouldn't even expect, or you wouldn't even be able to search with keywords, but you just happen to see them. And that's often sometimes like a little gem in your edit. I want to just jump into one of your other hats that you wear so splendidly, and that is the work that you have done in terms of training the next generation of film archivists. And it's an intensive training. It's one that is world class. And tell us a little bit about how that came about and how it functions today.
Yeah, I mean, we've been training in one way or another probably almost since we started, which, as you pointed out, was 40 years ago now, which seems incredible, but true. So from the very earliest days, we always had, I think we called them volunteers in those days, people that came in and helped us interpret our material. I mean, because we're such an eclectic archive and we have subjects that are so wide and so global and across so many decades, it means that in-house, I can't expect to have experts on all the subjects I'm looking at. So from the very beginning, we were bringing in people. Have a look at our railway films. Tell us what sort of train that is. Have a look at this war film. Tell us who that general is. I mean, of course, it's a bit easier now because you look things up online. I remember the days when we had a room full of catalogues to help us do this, but also those expert people who knew the subject already and could look at a film and interpret and catalogue it for us very well. So that's kind of how we started. But over the years, we began to realise that the opportunities for young people to learn how to be a film archivist is incredibly rare. Even in the UK, we used to, many, many years ago, have official training at one of the universities. Now there's a scattering of places that you can go to learn to be a film archivist. And my goodness, the number of moving images that are available are surely going up, not down. And this would lead us to believe that we have to think about how those moving images are looked after in the future. I don't just mean the sort of romantic side of celluloid and 35 millimetre, but also even the born digital. I mean, having good cataloguers and people that know how to use that material well must be a concern to us. And I think having a training in how to do that should be a goal.
It's a wonderful program that you offer. And as you mentioned, it's really not on the general programs for film studies in many countries. And it's something that I've always felt is a real need, because in order to make sure we have that, as I say, the next generation, and you've been educating many generations of great archivists. And I applaud you for doing that work, because without them, our job would be much more difficult. And as you say, every time we work with archives, we preserve it in our own way by using it in other films. And I know when we work with good people in the archives who understand the technology and they understand the requirements in terms of formatting and timing and all those things, it just makes our job so much easier as archive producers.
It does seem a shame to me that there are so many courses where you can do film studies, and yet so little will even offer one session about how a film archive works. I wish I could change that. It would be lovely.
It's true. I mean, we have a lot of cinematography and a lot of editing and a lot of writing courses. I see that in every country that I go to. And I'm always amazed that there's such there is not a profusion of good archive courses. So kudos to you for doing that. And it's also something we try to do at the Archive Market with the EFM, in terms of having programs and interviews with different people who work on both sides of the desk, archive producers and also archives. And I know we're all going to look forward to seeing you in Berlin on the 20th of February. I know there'll be lots more of those great conversations where you can talk to producers about some of your very unique collection. It's a collection unlike any other that I've ever seen or worked with. And so thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's been wonderful. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you.
Great. And we'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'd like to say a final thank you to our speakers, Monica Preischel, Marc Le Petit, and Amanda Huntley, and to the entire team at the European Film Market. We look forward to welcoming you on Tuesday, February 20th at the EFM Archive Market. This season of Industry Insights has been produced in cooperation with the Goethe Institute and is co-funded by Creative Europe Media. Please do tune in to future episodes of Industry Insights. Find us wherever you find your podcasts and on the website of the European Film Market, www.efm-berlinale.de. Thank you very much for listening. It's been my pleasure. Goodbye.